On June 7, 1992, three women vanished from a single-family home in the Missouri Ozarks. There was no DNA at the scene, and no bodies have been found. The only evidence of something amiss was a broken porch light. I'm Ann Roderick Jones, journalist and host of the Springfield 3, A Small Town Disappearance. Join me as I travel back to my hometown in the Ozarks to tell the story of Susie, Stacy, and Cheryl, three women who forever changed a Missouri town and the people in it. Available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Reverie True Crime. I'm your host, Paige. Data from Child Protective Services in the United States reflects the pattern around the world when it comes to children who are victims of child abuse. The overwhelming majority of offenders of child abuse are the biological parents, mostly mothers. Bringing awareness to this, the website called Breaking the Science says 71% of children killed by one parent are killed by their mothers. 60% of those victims are boys. DHHS data in the UK showed that of children abused by one parent between 2001 and 2006, 70.6% were abused by their mothers. 29.4% were abused by their fathers. When it comes to violence towards children, yes, fathers can be perpetrators, but what I've found through many statistics is that mothers are most likely to hurt and neglect their children, and it's a worldwide issue. It's not clear with these stats if the parents are together or not, but in this case today, we see that the stepfather was aware of some of the abuse, but also, he did nothing to stop it. Author and psychologist Meredith Fuller said in an article on kidspot.com.au, quote, "There is a societal idea that it's easy to have children. You should be able to cope and feel blessed. Abusive mothers are a very real problem, and we have to start talking about it to be able to help. We have no language around it. We have made it completely impossible for a mother to say, I feel violent, I want to harm my child, I'm overwhelmed and I don't know what to do. Mothers lash out because they're frustrated, angry, and feel despair. They want the noise to stop, the pain to stop, and they don't know what to do. We are in denial and it's harming children. We've created a culture where children can stand with their hands on their hips and say to their parent, you're not allowed to touch me. You can't hit me. And parents feel powerless. They can't cope, and we see the result of that, but we're not willing to talk about what we can do to help before it gets to that breaking point." End quote. If you're with someone that is abusing a child, and you're not doing a single thing to stop it, and attempt to get that adult some type of help, as well as protect the child, you are a part of the problem. We also have to start normalizing the fact that not every woman that has a baby is born with natural motherly instincts, or likes being a parent, but they feel forced to. Unfortunately, as a result of that, they may take it out on the child. So we need to start having the conversation about women who really hate being mothers. And this is the topic of the episode, which is why I'm harping on bad mothers. If this was an episode about an abusive father, I would discuss that issue. Also, I'm not talking about parents that are on TikTok and show the annoyances of being a parent. We all get annoyed with children, but it's when a parent or caretaker feels they're going to be violent towards that child that they need to start feeling comfortable with coming forward if they don't want to be a mother. And before it gets to the point of actually acting out on those thoughts. So we need to normalize mothers and parents in general coming out and feeling okay to talk about not wanting to be a parent and finding a way to help them before it gets to the point of abuse. So, without further ado, let's get started. Angela McAnulty was born in California. She was close with her mother, and they had a very loving relationship. Angela had two brothers, Mike and George. When Angela was 5 years old, her mother went out dancing and she was murdered. The case is unsolved, but Mike and George later said that their father was always a suspect and that they were all scared of him. After their mother passed away, their father became abusive. He starved the kids, beat them with belts, and the two boys would get punished with screwdrivers and wrenches. One night, one of the boys got famished, so he snuck into the kitchen to get a carrot. At the time, they now had a stepmother, and she caught him with the carrot. And instead of letting him just eat the carrot, she went straight to their father and tattletaled about him eating. And she knew what the consequences of that would be. Their dad came into the bedroom, jerked the boy up out of the bed by his hair, and beat him for simply eating because he was hungry. This abusive cycle was something that Angela would continue to carry on later, even though she knew from experience how wrong and hurtful it was. She left home and got into a relationship with a carnival worker, Anthony Maples. She was also abusing drugs around that time. Anthony and Jeanette went on to have two boys and one girl, Anthony Jr., Jeanette, and Brandon. Jeanette Maples was born on August 9, 1994. Angela was described as high-strung and controlling towards everyone. She didn't make a lot of money and even lived in her car for a while. After she had children, she began the cycle of abuse by slowly isolating them from everyone. Angela and Anthony went to jail on drug charges, and their children were put into foster care in 1995 in Sacramento, California. Jeanette, Brandon, and Anthony Jr. were in foster care until 2001. The two boys requested that they stay in foster care and did not want to be with their own mother. Now that's a huge red flag. Angela was working as a cashier and had another daughter who she named Patience, which is awfully odd since that is something Angela absolutely did not have. By this time, she had Jeanette back in her custody, and in 2002, she married a trucker named Richard McAnulty. They had a son, and in 2005, moved to Eugene, Oregon, with Patience, Jeanette, and their son. Patience would later say that when Jeanette was reunited with her mother, the abuse immediately began. When the family got settled in Eugene, Oregon, Jeanette, in the middle of her sixth grade year, began going to Cascade Middle School in 2006. Jeanette was an awesome child and student. She was shy and often teased for her grimy and tattered clothes. Despite the bullying, Jeanette did enjoy school. She loved writing, studying, and learning poetry, and a big plus for her was being away from home. In 7th and 8th grade, she had perfect attendance at school and a few friends, but her friends were not allowed to come over. Jeanette could only see them at school. Angela, of course, did not want anyone there to see what was going on in the home. There were skeletons to hide away in the closets from the outside world. No one could know what Jeanette was suffering from a daily basis by the hands of her so-called mother. Jeanette would also dive into books to escape the reality of her life. She attempted to hide the secrets that were on her skin over the course of her years at Cascade Middle School, but friends would soon see these secrets uncovered. While in gym class, her friends noticed all of the bruising on Jeanette's body while she was changing clothes. For a while, Jeanette ran with the lie that the dark marks all over her legs, abdomen, and back were from falling down. She was also extremely hungry every day and very eager to even have a bite of food. When it came time to pack up from school and go home, her friends always noticed the sadness that overwhelmed Jeanette. She was also visibly experiencing anxiety when it was time to leave school and go back to what no one knew was a house of extensive torment. After a while, Jeanette's friends were done with her answers when they would ask what was going on, because they knew she was lying. They began to put pressure on Jeanette to tell them the truth. They were worried. Jeanette finally admitted to some things, such as her mom abusing and starving her, but she didn't go into detail about all the horrible things that her mother would do to her. Jeanette's friend Amber said she begged Jeanette to go get help, but she wouldn't, because she thought it would make her mother furious, which would cause her to be in even more trouble. This friend, Amber Davis, told her parents what Jeanette confided to her. Amber's mother then called the child welfare office, and Jeanette even wrote a letter herself to a teacher saying that she was not allowed to eat, that her mother forced her to eat hot peppers, and made her sit on her knees for long amounts of time. When Amber's mother called the child welfare, they didn't seem to take her seriously, even going so far as to say that secondhand accounts of abuse were not that important or serious enough to send anyone out to the home. Except on one occasion, and whoever that caseworker was, which we'll get into, they were truly dreadful at their job. The secondhand information excuse angered me so much because that's what you're supposed to do when you know or even suspect someone is getting abused. The person that's being abused likely can't call themselves, and the abuser isn't going to call. It's up to us to bring these situations to light and call for help. All the social workers did was brush it off. Jeanette graduated from the 8th grade in 2008, and she was then taken out of the school by her mother. She had told Amber that she was petrified of this ever happening, and said if it did happen, things would get worse, and she was unfortunately right. DHS had been called so many times that Angela pulled Jeanette out of school, hoping that would take the heat off of her and people would stop calling. From this point forward, Jeanette would no longer have much contact at all with anyone. She was in a hell that was worse than any prison. Her younger sister Patience was also getting abused, but not to the extent that Jeanette was, but she was getting abused as well. I'm going to get into what was being done to Jeanette. So if you don't want to hear this part, I completely understand, and you can hit that skip button a few times if you'd like. Court records state, Angela did not allow Jeanette to speak to her sister Patience or her brother. She forced Jeanette to eat hot peppers, stand or kneel in a corner for hours, at times while having to hold heavy objects. Angela punched, slapped, scratched, and kicked Jeanette all over her body, after she made Jeanette remove her clothes. This, of course, caused bruises, cuts, and sometimes she would knock her daughter's teeth out. Angela constantly took belts, a sewing yardstick, and sticks from trees, beating Jeanette's face, scratching her face, beating her unclothed back, butt, and legs, causing bleeding and gashes. Angela forced her daughter to stay in one room by herself, rarely letting her out. This was so she could carry out all of her violence in private. She would turn on the vacuum or turn up the television volume so no one could hear Jeanette's screams and cries. After extremely violent beatings, Angela would put iodine where she had inflicted lacerations. She would put bandages on the wounds and would never take her to get medical or dental help. The violence was so bad, the flesh was coming off of Jeanette. Richard would never stop these things from happening. He didn't even try. And not only did he not try, whether it was because he feared Angela since it was stated that she would physically assault him on occasion, or whatever stopped him from intervening, he also did not tell anyone about any of this or try to get proper treatment for his stepdaughter. Even though Richard was by no means innocent in all of this, obviously, he was gone a lot out of town, driving across the country, working weeks at a time, and really didn't know all of the gruesome details of everything until later. We find out a little bit about what he did know later on, and even condoned. So even though he didn't know all the gruesome details, he definitely knew enough to know that what he was doing and what Angela was doing was not right, and that she and Jeanette both needed help. After Richard had a heart attack in the summer of 2009, the family moved from the house they were living in, which was on Robin Avenue, to another house on Howard Avenue. Angela's abusive ways started to intensify. She made Jeanette suffer more physical torture and starved her more than she ever did before. Jeanette was always dehydrated and she was emaciated. She had wounds so much worse that they would even get infected. She would beat on Jeanette's chest, feet, hands, arms, legs, and once she hit Jeanette so hard with her hand that Jeanette fell backwards into a door and injured her head severely. Angela would turn the water off at night, getting under the sink and messing with the pipes so Jeanette could not get anything to drink. She also kept the cupboards locked so Jeanette could not eat. She caused injuries so severe to her daughter that her bones were showing. Later, detectives suspected that pliers were used to cut her flesh to the bone. However, those suspicions have never been confirmed. Jeanette's face was later described as, quote, disfigured and having the appearance of a concentration camp victim, end quote. There were many times when Angela would tie Jeanette up while she beat her. The teenager was forced to sleep on a piece of cardboard in a blood-spattered bedroom. The cardboard was mainly for her to sleep on as a way to not get blood soaked into the carpet. Later, when investigated, there were chunks of Jeanette's skin found in the room that she was tortured in. Angela would make Jeanette go outside. Sometimes she would make patients do this. They would have to go outside and find dog feces to bring back to Angela. And Angela would take the dog poop and smear it on Jeanette's face and mouth. She would force Jeanette to ask if she could go to the bathroom. The bathroom was always locked as well. Sometimes she would tell Jeanette that she could not go to the bathroom. Jeanette would get so thirsty, she drank the toilet water because there was no other way for her to get anything at all to drink. Richard had to have open heart surgery at one point and was in the hospital for a while. This is when Jeanette's step-grandmother, Richard's mother, Lynn, saw Jeanette. She said, quote, "Jeanette looked bad, really thin. Her hair had been chopped off and she had a busted lip." Lynn also recalled that it looked like someone had taken their fist and ripped Jeanette's hair out. Jeanette's step-grandmother Lynn began calling child welfare authorities anonymously. She lived in Leeburg, Oregon, and didn't get to see her grandkids very often. The first time she called anonymously, she told DHS that she was a neighbor and that they needed to go check on the kids. Lynn told them that the older girl was extremely thin, and a social worker told her that they would look into it. Parents, teachers, friends, and family members put their trust in these social workers, but Child Protective Services failed Jeanette. They did nothing. Ultimately, the social workers kept saying that this was all secondhand information and they didn't investigate these calls as they should have. DHS did go to the house once after a school official called, but this caseworker was told conflicting information by Angela, who said her daughter was a compulsive liar, and the others in the home. The caseworker saw that there was plenty of food in the house, and she left, writing in the file, quote, "unable to determine." Nobody knew that the social workers were not doing their jobs to the best of their ability. If they had known, most of them have said that they would have called the police instead. In October, Lynn went to visit Richard, Angela, and the kids. Jeanette was facing a wall when she walked in. She walked over to her granddaughter and tried to talk to her, but she couldn't say anything of importance because Angela was right on her heels. Angela said the cut on Jeanette's lip had been the result of a bad fall. When Jeanette's step-grandmother departed from the home, she called DHS yet again. She kept calling. When she left the McAnulty home, it would be the last time that she ever saw Jeanette alive, despite her efforts of repeatedly trying to save her. She even called DHS within days of Jeanette's death. At the beginning of December 2009, Jeanette endured a significant blow to her head. After this, she was very confused and could barely stand and had difficulty walking. December 9th, 2009, right before the fatal event occurred, a caseworker had just left the home. Documents that were unsealed in 2011 said a Child Protective Service worker found scars on Jeanette's young sister patients. These scars were all over her legs, arms, and back. Patients swore that the scratches were from a cat, and she told the caseworker that she was scared that her mother would be taken away from the family. On December 9th, 2009, caseworker Nicole Brown said Jeanette's sister, quote, "became very nervous and started shaking," end quote. And that's when Nicole was asking patients to look at her arms and legs. Quote, "I then noticed several scars up and down her arms, legs, and lower back. They were very narrow and faint in nature, but very numerous. She immediately told me they were from being scratched by a cat. I asked her how a cat had scratched her lower back. She was unable to tell me and continued shaking." She continued to write that patients told her, quote, "My mom isn't going to spank us anymore. She is trying not to. She said she was just going to do timeouts now, end quote. Prosecutor Eric Hasselman said that the investigators had a doctor examine patients, but she still kept telling them that the scars were caused by a cat that she tried to hold too tightly. The affidavit also included a statement from another state caseworker who interviewed Jeanette's half-brother, who was 5 at the time. He was also taken into state protective custody. The 5-year-old told caseworker April Mackey that Jeanette had to go to the hospital because, quote, "my mom hurt her." He told April Mackey, quote, "there was blood all over her." He went on to pick up 2 pieces of his toy racetrack to show the caseworker how his mother often did what he called double hits during a spanking. April Mackey wrote, quote, "he proceeded to hit his SpongeBob stuffed animal with a racetrack piece in both hands. He swung at the doll continuously and stated, 'she hits hard, and I mean hard.'" December 9, 2009, sometime after the caseworker had left the home, step-grandmother Lynn's phone rang. She answered to hear her son Richard and Angela. They were in a panic and extremely rattled by something. Angela told Lynn that Jeanette was cold to the touch and was not breathing. Lynn could only scream for them to call 911, and they did. Court records say that Jeanette supposedly fell asleep on the floor and eventually stopped responding, going on to say that Angela and Richard put Jeanette in the bathtub, then called Lynn, who told them to call 911. It's suspected, due to Jeanette only weighing 50 pounds, that she likely went into cardiac arrest. Firefighters arrived first to find Jeanette laying on her back, topless with wet hair, in the living room. I can only guess that they tried to splash cold water on her in the bathtub and then took her out and placed her back on the floor. The firefighters said by her weight and figure, she looked way younger than 15. The fire captain even asked Angela multiple times how old Jeanette was, because he just couldn't believe it. The lead paramedic was met by Angela in the driveway, and she was talking so fast he could barely understand a word she was saying, but understood she was saying something about Jeanette falling down and that she had seemed fine about an hour before the call to 911. Richard never said a word. Right away, this paramedic knew this child did not fall. He said that she did not have a shirt on, her hair was wet, she was covered in bruises on her face with cuts above her eye, and he could see her bones, she was so emaciated. The EMTs performed CPR and put a tube in the teenager's lungs, hoping to get her to breathe. Angela was all over the place, at one point seeming frantic, nervous, really quiet, then crying, and she even laughed a few times. The fire captain remembered thinking it was such a weird response that he'd never seen before. He even said the hair on the back of his neck stood straight up, and he had not ever felt like that in his whole career. All he said he wanted to do was run in that moment. He called his supervisor and police soon after as he cried, which is something else he said he had never done on the job. The ambulance hurried Jeanette to the hospital, where Dr. Elizabeth Hilton attempted to treat her, but she was lifeless. The lead paramedic, who had said this was no fall, was by Jeanette's side when they pronounced her dead at the hospital that night at 8:42 p.m. The doctor was informed that the teenage girl did not have any prior problems medically, but there were cuts and wounds on her mouth that were trying to heal, and she obviously needed medical attention before this, but did not get it. Jeanette's front teeth were broken. She had extreme injuries on her back and legs. When the doctor met with Angela and asked her questions, her only reply was that Jeanette had been eating, but lately she had really gotten thin. Richard and Angela were taken from the hospital into custody for questioning, and for 2 days, the DA, authorities, and medical examiner were figuring out what really happened to Jeanette Maples. Her siblings were taken into protective custody. At first, detectives left the house with many boxes of evidence, and poor grandmother Lynn was left to clean out the house, which would be a nightmare because she would have more insight into what she could only imagine at that time had happened in that home. She would later say that the house was filthy. There were toys and trash scattered everywhere. The kitchen cabinets were padlocked, and there was a bedroom that had blood everywhere. The investigators pleaded with Lynn not to go see her step-granddaughter's body because they said it was the most horrific sight they'd ever seen. In court documents, giving the severity of Jeanette's continual starvation, dehydration, physical injuries, and localized infections, authorities were unable to pinpoint a single cause of death. The cause of death instead was listed as being brought about by neglect, maltreatment, and happened during or as a result of intentional maiming and torture. Angela, 41 years old at the time, and Richard, 40, were charged with aggravated murder. Jeanette's biological father, Anthony Maples, was living in Sacramento, California, and learned about Jeanette's passing by way of a phone call from a social worker. He had not seen or heard from Jeanette in almost 10 years. He had gotten himself clean of drugs and was attending college. Anthony had not spoken to Angela or Jeanette since they left California in 2000. He did try his best to contact them through the years, but of course, Angela would not talk to him or let him talk to Jeanette. When the social worker called Anthony, she didn't give him many details, but said that his daughter had been murdered and that it was really horrific. Anthony said, quote, "I am so crushed by this. I know that I have to accept this as God's will, but it's disgusting that this happened to my little angel," end quote. Sourcing from the Oregonian from January 2nd, 2010, it states, after 2009, there were 5 years of critical incident reviews into child deaths and serious injuries of youngsters who've had contact with the DHS. 21 reports since 2004 identify a myriad of problems, including a failure to investigate and follow up on cases, inadequate documentation, and lack of ongoing assessment. David Paul, an attorney from Portland, who sued the department on behalf of 10 children, said, quote, "This agency cannot hold itself out as protecting children when they repeatedly fail. I am tired of hearing they need new resources. They don't need new regulations or a blue ribbon panel. What's needed is accountability and public oversight, and it's just not happening," end quote. At first, Angela denied everything. Then she blamed Richard. Then she admitted she spanked her daughter. Finally, she did tell everything she had carried out on Jeanette. Richard was told he would probably get a lighter sentence due to his heart condition. He claimed that he spanked her, but then he took it back, and instead agreed to take the blame for Jeanette's death. However, Angela already spilled the beans in her interrogation. In February of 2011, Angela pleaded guilty to the aggravated murder charge, admitting that she had tortured and maimed Jeanette for years. She also pleaded guilty to destroying or altering physical evidence because she did try to sanitize some areas of the home before anyone got there, as well as throw away clothes, sticks, belts, bedding, and the cardboard that Jeanette slept on. It would soon be in the jury's hands to decide Angela's fate, and the prosecution was really wanting the death penalty. In February 2012, Angela came into the courtroom wailing and crying, saying she knew what she did was wrong. Her defense team went on to console her as she wiped her face with Kleenex and put her head down on the table during the prosecution's opening argument. The prosecutor was posing the question of whether Angela should get life in prison or face the death penalty for murdering her own child. Richard was also charged with aggravated murder. He was not as involved in the abuse as Angela, but he definitely did not stop it or tell anyone about it. When it came to Richard, the prosecution decided not to try for the death penalty. Angela was sentenced to death. The jury unanimously returned agreeing to these questions: whether the conduct of the defendant that caused the death of the deceased was committed deliberately and with the reasonable expectation that death of the deceased or another would result; whether there is a probability that the defendant would commit criminal acts of violence that would constitute a continuing threat to society; if raised by the evidence, whether the conduct of the defendant in killing the deceased was unreasonable in response to the provocation, if any, by the deceased; and lastly, whether the defendant should receive a death sentence. They all agreed on these questions. When Angela's sentence was announced, she was described as stoic. She said that she was at peace with the decision, but that she was very sorry for hurting her daughter in such a bad way, that she knows she did wrong, and that she did not intend for her daughter to die. Angela is only the second woman in Oregon history to face execution. Specifically, the first woman sentenced to die in Oregon since the state brought back the death penalty in 1984. As for Richard, he was sentenced to 25 to life. Sourcing from OregonLive.com, quote, "Prosecutor Eric Hasselman said the Lane County District Attorney's Office probably had enough evidence to prosecute Richard McAnulty for aggravated murder as an accessory to his wife's actions, yet chose to allow the lesser plea because of his intellectual limitations and her manipulation of him," end quote. So it came to light during this trial that Angela originally wanted to bury Jeanette instead of calling 911, but Richard finally took some initiative when it was far too late to try to save Jeanette. It was also revealed that he has an IQ of 80. His mother made all of his decisions for him until he met Angela when he was 32 years old, and then she took over the role of making all of his decisions. In serious situations, he can't focus well enough to make split decisions and he shuts down. So, along with his physical disabilities after his heart attack and heart surgery, he was intellectually disabled as well. However, he does acknowledge that he was guilty, he withheld food and water from Jeanette, and should have done more. He admitted that he didn't know about the torture since he was driving a long-haul truck across the country for his job for weeks at a time until he had his heart attack, and in 2009 he became disabled. So he was at home more and started to see a lot more than he ever knew was happening. Due to his catheter that became infected, he often fainted a lot, and he was hospitalized frequently and had profuse bleeding. Richard said that he, quote, became aware of the nature of the abuse and let it continue without taking steps to prevent it, and at times told Angela it was fine to not give Jeanette food or water. In the plea petition, it says, quote, finally, shortly before her death, Jeanette showed Richard the extent of her injuries and the blood-spattered room where she had absorbed most of Angela's whippings. Richard did nothing to protect Jeanette, thus neglecting his duty towards his stepdaughter when she needed him the most. The prosecutor stated, despite his intellectual limitations, Richard McAnulty, quote, is an adult. He was well aware of what was going on under his roof, and he could have intervened in time to save this child. He also read a statement from Patience, Jeanette's little sister, which said she completely blamed Richard for, quote, obeying the punishment rules for Jeanette when my mom was out of the house. Patience also said that Richard told Angela what they were doing was not wrong. She went on to say that Richard favored his biological son that he had with Angela and did not harm him, but would be abusive to her and her sister. In conclusion, Patience said, quote, with all of this said, I think my childhood is not ruined, but depressing. I'm slowly healing, end quote. She thanked her friends, foster family, and other people for cheering her on from near and far. On August 3rd, 2020, the Lane County Circuit Court made the decision to approve a settlement agreement in which Lane County prosecutors agreed to drop their appeal of a 2019 ruling abolishing the death sentence for Angela, and she agreed to drop her appeals of her murder conviction. Now, Angela only must serve life in prison without the possibility of parole and will not be executed. This was all based on a new law that was passed, which states, quote, notably, in 2019, the Oregon legislature passed SB 1013, reducing the potential penalties for defendants who murder children through intentional maiming and torture. For any defendant sentenced for that crime, now the lesser charge of murder in the first degree, after January 1, 2020, including those who committed the crime before January 1, 2020, the maximum sentence is life imprisonment without the possibility of parole, end quote. And that, everyone, concludes today's episode. My thoughts are definitely with Patience and her half-brother. I really hope they are doing as well as they possibly can be, and I'm glad that they don't have to see or suffer from any of this abuse any longer. I know in 2011, Patience told a judge that she was very pleased with the foster home that she had been in for 13 months at the time, and asked to be appointed there permanently with the foster care home she was in rather than being put up for adoption, and the judge granted that. The little boy was in a different foster home and he was awaiting adoption. If you know or suspect someone is the victim of child abuse, please call your local Child Protective Services and the police department. Put continuous pressure on them to at least investigate the situation. You can always remain anonymous. If you suspect something, know, or see something, always speak up and be the voice for the voiceless. Thank you so much, as always, for tuning in. And until next time, please stay safe and take care.